Aloha. It's Tuesday, June 25th. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. We hear from the Heritage Group today, Falls of Clyde International in Glasgow, Scotland, about the latest efforts to scuttle the former Matson ship or save it. We get reaction to the governor's list of bills he may veto that was released last week. We also hear from Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami, who is just back from a trip to the heartland for a mayor's conference. And Maui families who lost their homes to last year's wildfires could rebuild faster thanks to help from Hawaii's architects. The conversation starts right after the latest local and national headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Scottish Heritage Group, Falls of Clyde International, isn't giving up of saving the historic sailing ship after which it's named. It was built back in 1879, and 2025 marks a decade that the group has tried to work with the state and the local group, Friends of the Falls of Clyde, to return the ship back to its native Glasgow. The iron and steel sailing vessel sits at Honolulu Harbor. Earlier this month, officials published the final environmental assessment for the Falls of Clyde, which spells out the state's preferred alternative, which is to dismantle the vessel. We talked to David O'Neill from Glasgow this morning. He feels that the State Harbors Division was disingenuous about saying it really wanted to work with his group. He believes he is offering a solution to save the ship and get it out of the harbor.
We're a heritage group trying to save a big part of our heritage, and we felt that in the conversations and discussions with the authorities and DOT, that we had effectively mitigated the need for a performance bond. And the way we were doing that was that we had offered to DOT that they keep the advance funding that was due to us as the contract winner. And during the discussions prior to the award, they seemed happy with that. And we, I think we slipped up there, I suppose. We felt that we'd covered it. But then when it came to the award, they then came back and said, what about the bond? Well, didn't we cover that with, no, that's still outstanding. Right, so that's an issue. And historically, and this is picking up from before, as a heritage group, we're not in the maritime sector, and we couldn't ever meet any sort of bond of that level. And we've never been in this industry before in relation to maritime requirements or regulations. So we were sort of running about at the last minute to find out how we could deal with this. Certainly, harbours weren't going to change their point of view, even though we were giving them a solution after all these years that would take the ship away and take away their headache, but while retaining very strong links to Hawaii once the ship in Scotland had been rebuilt. And so that's why the comments recently about, you know, we're very keen to work together with a third party to save the ship. We'd all like to. I personally feel that's absolute nonsense, because after the end of the last process, in fact, when Dre was, I believe, reappointed, my understanding was that she spoke to Bruce McLean and said, you know, let's move forward, let's get this moving, let's find a solution, and we'll try and make the whole bond package more attractive so that the third party from Scotland, us, Falls of Clyde International, that we could complete the process then and preserve the history of both countries, which is very important to me. And I did think to many people in Hawaii too. And that was, I think, about a year ago when Dre Kalele came back. However, the advance notice that we've seen of what's likely to come in the already stated preferred choice of what happens to the ship is to break her up in the water where she sits. So on one hand, we want to work with the people from Scotland to save the ship. And yet, on the other hand, we have a preferred choice, which is we want to destroy it. And where I have an issue is my understanding of the advance documentation that we've seen for the intended RFP to come, is that there is support to break her up in the water, financial support for a contractor to come in and do that job for the state, which will entail closing off that part of the town where the university is and other tourist attractions in that area for however long it's likely to take. Then disposal of all the materials that are coming from that, including pollutants, which there are, as well as the material itself, because my understanding is there is no ship breaker in Hawaii. So therefore, they're getting a construction company with no experience to break a ship in the water with all the hazards that brings with it. But from our perspective, what gets me is that they have now ruled out sinking at sea, which was never going to happen before. There was a hope from the dive community that she could be sunk just off there. That was never going to happen because of the size of the ship. And we know that there is only a pre-approved location. So that's a bit of a non-starter. So that's 2 points that have been included, as they want to sink her as one option in the predestined zones that they have used before. Well, now, previously, this lady had advised us, and certainly had advised, and my understanding was the Friends of Falls of Clyde locally, that they had everything in place before to sink the ship. Everything was ready. If you don't do it, we're going to do it anyway. And it was that material threat, the fear of loss. They were threatening all this. If you don't do it, we're going to sink it. We are going to sink it, unless you can do something. And yet, it never materialised, because we then took a stance that we reached out to the EPA and to the US Coast Guard and to Historic Hawaii to say, have you given permission for this to happen? And each of those authorities were not aware what she was talking about. They hadn't been consulted. EPA were very unhappy that there was no plans or conversation with them prior. Now, as I say, she was only saying that to us and to our friends in Hawaii. And that may have just been a bluff to get us to move. But this is what I mean about the conversation being disingenuous and in some cases maybe a bit unprofessional there to do something like that. So that was the plan last time, and we put a stop to it through these bodies. And I believe it was Historic Hawaii that stepped in and said, no, you can't do that because there is a historical element here and we need to address these points. So that bought time. Then they decided to issue a new RFP, which, you know, we went for and we won. And then, unfortunately, we couldn't meet the performance requirement of the advance payments that were due to us under the contract would have been more than enough to meet the bond requirement. They just point blank refused, which made me think their whole motivation here, what is it? Because we were giving them a solution and they were funding effectively the project themselves then. So the risk was taken away as far as requiring a bond, but they refused. So as I say, we move on. Dre is now saying, we want to work together. However, they're putting a precondition, as I understand it, that for us, a third party, to come again to Hawaii with the plan that they accepted 2 years ago, it's the same plan, it hasn't changed. Their idea is that what they're insisting now, I believe, if I've read the document correctly, is that they're now going to insist that we put the ship into Pacific Shipyard or another dry dock and that we carry out repairs to the hull before she leaves. Well, first of all, that makes the whole thing unviable, because what it does is it adds nearly $5 million to the cost of the whole operation, never mind what it's going to cost the state to do this if we were successful. And we know this because we've already been engaged with two shipyards in Hawaii, and they both wanted, I believe, one was a $3 million bond and the other one was a $2 million bond. So this bonding thing, which I know is quite common in the United States, we don't do it, but I understand why it's there. So if we were to put the ship into a dry dock, I've had this with a cursory estimate before that just to stabilize the hull would be in the region of $2 to $3 million. That's before the cost of even leaving Hawaii. Now, our argument is, and I've made this point back to Harbour's Department, there is no need for us to stabilize the hull because our plan last time and again just now is that a lift ship would come up behind Pier 7 and the ship would literally float her same length inside the lift ship. The door closes and it takes her away. So from our perspective, we know the ship badly needs hull plating, repair. We know all of that. We've seen the previous surveys, both by Mr. Tamburini, both his surveys that he did in 2016, I think it was, and more recently for the Harbours Department. Point of interest there, actually, even on his surveys, he does comment at the end of each survey, if an angel investor could be found, this vessel could be restored.
Well, what happens now then?
We've got to wait until the RFP comes out. I'm hoping by this conversation, DOT might listen and realise that if you remove that obstacle to that condition of putting her into a dry dock before she leaves Hawaii and moderate the terms of the bond or consider what we proposed previously, you have an instant solution. Now, we're working on another project for another ship and we deal with a lift ship company. I've already asked them this week to get me a cost for Hawaii because it's not the same contractor we were using before. But that's how seriously we're taking this. So what I'm hoping to achieve is from this conversation, word might get back to Harbour's Department that, you know, there is a plan, there is a deal to be done here that would minimise cost and disruption to the state. I spoke to a leading expert in historic ships who has seen this ship. And yes, there are various surveys out just now. And I've asked him, despite that you've seen all of these reports, if we had a dry dock and everything in place at this end, and we want to replate the ship entirely and replace the deck plating, we would take out all of the old oil infrastructure because we want to restore her to how she was built in 1878 as an open cargo ship. Could that be done? And he replied, it's very possible.
We've been hearing from David O'Neill of the Falls of Clyde International, a group out of Scotland, which is still holding out some hope to save the historic vessel from being dismantled at the Honolulu Pier. We did reach out to the Department of Transportation earlier this morning, and it says it still expects to go out to bid on the removal of the ship later this summer.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's DAIKIN, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Claudia Lamoureux, founder of Mindful Digital Life and parenting coach. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to live well with technology.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting singer and actress Macy Gray performing songs such as I Try and Still in two sets nightly this Friday and Saturday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Hawaii senators are back in special session this week to vote on a list of potential new judges. And while there was talk about bringing back the House of Representatives in a full session to deal with a growing insurance crisis, that hasn't materialized yet. HPR reporter Ashley Mazua has been tracking these issues at the legislature and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, the other issue that might bring or might prompt a special session is a move to override a veto. And Governor Josh Green just released that veto list last week. And you were able to talk to House and Senate leadership about that list.
Right. Yeah. And so the overarching theme of this veto list is really related to the state's finances and the governor's emergency powers. You know, in a statement, Green wrote that the state's financial outlook really was the reason that drove a lot of these decisions to put some of these lists, some of these bills on this intent to veto list. I spoke with House Speaker Scott Sikey, who wasn't totally surprised that some of the fiscal bills made it on the list.
Well, I was generally aware that there may have been some fiscal bills that would be on the list. And I was told that the governor would work to find ways to fund some of these programs or to provide the funding through his authority to reallocate funds within the state budget.
And, you know, the state will need to cover a drop in its projected revenue because the Council of Revenues came together about a month ago and said that, you know, revenue is looking down. And so they'll need to find also ways to cover the massive income tax cut that they also passed and the governor signed. And that's supposed to ramp up over the next 8 years. So I believe the state is facing about a $65 million drop in projected revenue this year. And then they will also have to compensate about $200 million for the income tax cut. So the governor is considering vetoing a $300 million infusion into the state's rainy day fund. He says that that money should actually go towards the state's carryover funds, which have been depleted because they were used to cover pandemic hazard pay for state workers. So kind of to put this in perspective, we had about a little over $1 billion at the start of the year in carryover funds. And this is just money in the budget that's not necessarily attached or like allocated to anything yet. And now that's down to about $100 million. Meanwhile, the state's $1.5 billion rainy day fund, which is their reserve fund, is the largest it's ever been. Green's administration also explained that in the bill, there was in that $300 million. Green is also considering vetoing a measure that would have given $450 million to Maui recovery. And he says that those funds should actually be put in the major disaster fund, which he has more control over. But Green committed to carrying out the appropriations legislators outlined in the measure. Another reason why they decided he's thinking about vetoing this measure is there was a budgeting issue that resulted in the elimination of funding for the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation. And so by vetoing this measure, it would actually restore the budget for affordable housing projects. Senate Ways and Means Committee Chair Donovan Dela Cruz says the bills were written to be more inclusive of the legislature.
The fact is, some of those monies could still be deposited. And when Maui may need additional assistance, the governor can always send down a bill as part of his legislative package that requires money from the rainy day fund. I think that would be a little more conservative approach, so that we can put it in the rainy day fund. And then when needed, I'm sure the legislature is going to be open to making sure that Maui gets the assistance it needs.
And so, you know, any use of the rainy day fund actually requires approval from 2/3 majority of lawmakers. And that's why it's seen as a last resort. Dela Cruz said that when he looked at the veto list, he noted that the governor would probably prefer more unrestricted use of that major disaster fund. And while he doesn't agree with all the vetoes, he understands the rationale.
And what about the non-money bills?
So Green is also considering vetoing a measure that Dela Cruz introduced that would establish reporting requirements and deadlines for the governor when using the emergency funds. So during the legislative process, Governor Green wrote to HPR in an email that he didn't have issues with the bill's approach. And he had said, and I quote, "The governor is a strong proponent of transparency and cooperation with the legislature. And since this does not significantly curtail or limit the governor's authority to make crucial decisions during times of emergency, we don't take much issue with the approach of this bill." But now the administration has come back and says that this bill might actually will hinder his ability to respond in times of emergency. Green may also veto a measure that would remove the ability for the governor or mayor to suspend electronic media transmission during a state of emergency. Media organizations have been, you know, fighting to have this taken out. They say that this is Hawaii's one of the only states in the country that has this provision in their law. And they say in the wrong hands, this bill could really hurt the public who rely on news for vital information during times of emergency. I spoke with Chris Leonard, the Hawaii Broadcasting Association president, and he's also the State Emergency Communications Committee chair.
This puts the communities at risk, and it also is, as I mentioned, is a prior restraint. It's a First Amendment constitutional issue that I think they need to take a very, very good look at here. I think for us as broadcasters, what we're trying to do is make sure that we can continue to do what we're supposed to do, and that is provide potentially life-saving information in times of an emergency. And that's a time when our communities need more communication, not less.
But Green says electronic media could be used in an attack to activate a deadly device, or that social media could be used to activate dangerous crowds. And he wanted to see a more balanced approach in the bill. Another important one in danger of being vetoed is one that would allow owner-builder exemptions on rental properties so they wouldn't need a licensed contractor. The idea was to decrease barriers to building homes, but Green is concerned about quality and safety standards if this bill passes.
Okay, so what happens next?
So Psyche and Dela Cruz say that both chambers will be meeting this week to discuss overriding any of the vetoes, which would require a two-thirds majority from the legislature. As you said, the Senate is back to consider those judicial appointments. And there was a, as you were saying earlier, there was a period of time when Governor Green said that, you know, in the event of a big insurance disaster, we would potentially come back for a special session to talk about that. I haven't heard anything about that yet, and the people who I spoke to also haven't. So anyway, they're back in session now, the Senate is, to consider those judicial appointments. However, Psyche says, you know, if the measures are vetoed, they can work over the summer to bring back some of these measures next session.
Okay, all right. But
there are a number of
Sorry. we'll play that Psyche clip now.
There are a number of bills that are more substantive in nature where he has some specific policy concerns or procedural concerns or substantive concerns. And, you know, those may require some work over the summer so that we can introduce them again in January.
Right. So they could consider working on them over the summer and then potentially bring them back in the next session. So Green has until July 10th to veto these measures. But if the changes are small enough, the legislature can fix them in between now and then.
Okay. So it doesn't seem like there's any major like deal breaker thing.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and this is just, again, a list. So Green can decide to not veto any of these measures on this list, too. These are just the ones that he's considering. So this is the legislature kind of has time to go over this list and talk amongst themselves and see if it is really important that some of these measures get overridden or the veto gets overwritten for some of these measures.
Okay. And I know on the insurance crisis month front that one of the experts that we talked to yesterday had said that it seems like in the last few weeks things have just been holding. No other bad news has come out. So that may just be the attitude of wait and see. And see how it plays out.
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo with reaction to the governor's potential veto list.
On the next Fresh Air, the director of the 2023 adaptation of The Color Purple, the musical, Blitz Bazawule, joins us to talk about his work as a director, painter, rapper, and novelist. He has a new exhibit of paintings about his formative years growing up in Ghana. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant. Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
Quite Illinois Mayor Derek Kawakami is back in the office this week after meeting with mayors from across the country. He joins us this morning live from the Garden Isle. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, everybody.
Yes, so I hope you had a chance to get your head in the ocean and clear it, reconnecting, with the ocean again.
Oh, you know me too well. I absolutely did.
Well, what was the big takeaway from this conference? Because I know this is a regular thing, but it's always good to check in with the other mayors.
You know, I've been involved with the U.S. Conference of Mayors from day one, from 2018. And I think, you know, the biggest takeaway is that this is a wonderful bipartisanship collaborative of mayors from big cities and very small counties, smaller than Kauai. And it's realizing that we have common denominators when it comes to issues. The very enlightening takeaway and what has really strengthened my faith in this nation, though, is the ability of mayors to come together despite what party you're from or what your beliefs are, but to really focus on common denominator issues and well-thought-out solutions that we can all share.
Well, was there any particular thing that got you excited this session?
I think the biggest thing over the course of the year, because it hits close to home, is under Mayor Skeevy's leadership. She was the U.S. Conference of Mayors president for 2024. We do have another incoming president, Mayor Ginther from Columbus, Ohio. But Mayor Skeevy from Reno and I really connected because we share the experience of losing a very close loved one to suicide, and she has made it her mission and vision quest to tackle the mental health crisis, which she has indicated, and I would tend to agree, is one of the biggest healthcare issues that needs to be resolved in our lifetimes. And so we really focus our energy over the last year on mental health initiatives, and of course that will sort of spoke out to all the other issues as far as gun violence. I think it was eye-opening to hear how many different mayors have had their cities and counties traumatized by mass shootings in recent history. It leads off into homelessness, crime, and other areas that we tend to share with big cities and small cities as well. So I think the big thing that really excited me is seeing a collaborative and concerted effort from all mayors across the nation to really emphasize to Congress, to our constituents, to our healthcare system, to the insurance companies that we have dire needs when it comes to mental health capacity and treatment.
Well, you know, I know just driving around Honolulu, you know, and we see the homeless encampments and you know, you see someone in a, you know, in a psychotic break and you just know, gosh, they just need help.
Yeah, that is a common theme everywhere that I've traveled to, is that a large number of our homeless population are dealing with some sort of trauma, mental health issues, which often leads to self-treatment, and unfortunately, self-treatment usually means that they have a drug dependency or some sort of substance abuse issue that's underlying their problems as well. So it's very compounding, and, you know, we can trace it all the way back. You know, our nation used to have a robust system of state-run hospitals, primarily focused on psychiatric needs and recovery, and, you know, unfortunately, like many of our healthcare systems, and psychiatric wards and hospitals, they were understaffed, under-resourced, overpopulated, which led to a lot of the states just deciding that it was easier to shut down these facilities than to deal with the mounting lawsuits and costs to run these type of facilities. And hindsight being 2020, I think we all realized that was the wrong decision and the bad decision, because right now, you know, a lot of our residents and people that are dealing with mental health issues are either becoming incarcerated, which is the absolute worst way that you could try to treat mental health issues, or they're ending up on the streets, unfortunately.
Well, and I know that the last point in time count, noted that you had a slight increase in your homeless population. But, you know, lots of the same problems that the cities are facing. And I know here we've been watching the COVID counts, the cases surge a bit, you know, and we were concerned here, obviously, with the visitors that we had, the delegations from the FESPAC, festivities that we had. But last week, Kauai's numbers were up, and I know we're going to get fresh numbers tomorrow, but, you know, any concerns on that front right now?
Well, I guess the silver lining is that our numbers are up because people are either seeking treatment or they are reporting it in. So we have a large number of people that are still taking this virus serious. I think we've learned a lot about COVID-19 after going through the pandemic into where we are today. And people that have underlying health conditions or are vulnerable are especially on red alert whenever these type of case counts start to increase. And so all of our advice still heeds that if you are vulnerable or if you have underlying health conditions, we have to be reliant on protecting ourselves. I mean, early on, we required everybody to wear a mask, but nowadays it has really transitioned that if you need to, you should be wearing a mask. If you're sick, you should, just out of courtesy, right? I mean, it's kind of hard to hide the symptoms of COVID-19. So unless you want to be that person sneezing and coughing all over everybody, I think we've become a society that's well-conditioned that if we see somebody wearing a mask, that they're doing it out of courtesy or they're doing it because they themselves may be very vulnerable. But well, we're always concerned whenever people get sick. Our healthcare system on Kauai is fantastic. We have wonderful doctors and facilities, but we have to be mindful that they are people. Our healthcare workers are people. They have families, and they can get burnt out, and they have been burnt out. So we should do our part to lighten their load and do what's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know many of the cities are facing just weird weather. And, I don't know, how's Kauai doing just on recovery from the Kona low that we had recently or the flooding that you've seen?
Well, FEMA had just indicated that Kauai County did qualify for public assistance. So for our infrastructure damage, they will help to assist cover the cost. So we had New Malu Bridge that was impacted. That's going to be a very expensive project for us to do alone. So it's good to hear that we have an opportunity to seek FEMA reimbursement on those projects. We had some roads that were damaged. But, you know, unfortunately, we did not meet the threshold for individual assistance so that property owners that were impacted would be able to get federal assistance. There's, it has to rise to a certain monetary value for individuals to receive that type of assistance. I guess the silver lining in that situation is SBA has announced that they do have low interest loans that have become available. And we're just taking a look at, if we are going to see these type of storms more frequently. And as in past practice, we've seen the same areas flood over and over again. What sort of mitigative measures needs to be taken both by government, but also by the private property owner themselves to be able to be more resilient and suffer less loss.
And, you know, I do have to ask you about the incident that we had with that cruise ship that came really close to the Napali coast. And I know DLNR said, you know, they just don't have any evidence, to go after the cruise line. But I just would hate to think if a big cruise ship got stuck on a reef like that.
You know, whether or not they had the evidence to say that they were too close, just from me seeing the pictures, they were too close. and I wouldn't know what the distance from Napali is required by large type of vessels such as a cruise ship. But these captains and the cruise industry needs to be more mindful of where they're sailing and where they're bringing their passengers and what type of impacts it has on our ecosystem, our environment, and the marine life. And I can tell you, if they had run aground, we have all seen how complicated it is to just remove a yacht, a catamaran from the reef off of Maui, a very popular surf spot off of there. And I wouldn't be able to even fathom what it would take to tow a vessel the size of a cruise ship off of our reef, but more importantly, the permanent damage that it would do. So I'm pretty sure that Sue Konoho from the Kauai Visitors Bureau gave them a stern warning, one that you wouldn't want to get. And I'm pretty sure that the cruise industry has taken it to heart that for us it was a little too close for comfort.
Yes, well, let's hope so. All right, well, thank you so much, Mayor. I know you've got to go, but thanks so much for your time this morning.
Oh, thank you very much. It is great to be back home. Those poor folks on the eastern seaboard and the Midwest are going through a horrendous heat dome, and we just keep all of their residents in our thoughts because it was very, very hot. But you folks have a great day, and I'm so glad to be home.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We have been talking to Mayor, Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami, who just returned from a mayor's conference in Kansas City, Missouri. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Let's continue our Garden Island theme. We are spotlighting a historic suspension bridge commissioned in 1948 by the County of Kauai. The goal was to provide a safe route for cane field workers and their families to cross Hanamaulu Stream. Back then, it allowed communities of diverse backgrounds to interact with each other, and today is one of the last vestiges of the plantation era. It's also the only suspension bridge included in the Hawaii State Register of Historic Places. But after years of neglect and decay, officials closed it in 2006 and slated it for future removal. But there was a major setback in 2012 when a flash flood and fallen tree damaged the rotting wooden structure even more. This spurred a local movement to preserve and restore this historic monument from demolition. Today, you can revisit the rebuilt bridge, which was reconstructed according to the original plans. For today's quiz, can you name this backyard bridge? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NereidHawaii.com.
This week's performance at HPR's Hawaii Jazz Performance Series is sold out. Mahalo for your support. Watch videos from past HPR concerts and sign up for email alerts for future performances. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org, sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets.
Just a little bit deeper.
Maui County will hold its final wildfire recovery plan meeting this weekend to gather feedback for the development of Lahaina's long-term recovery plan. While the county continues to work on that, many wildlife survivors continue to focus on finding a place that they can call home. Many will land at one of the several temporary housing communities that will open up later this year. And for those looking to rebuild their houses, there are several options designed to help speed up the process available on the helpingmaui.org website. The site is run by the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement with input from the local chapters of the American Institute of Architects, or the AIA. The conversation's Russell Subiano talked with Maui-based architect Jeremy Stoddard about the architecture in the recovery efforts.
As an architect, you have a sense as how the architects that designed these kinds of communities and these types of homes, how they're able to maximize space while still giving residents privacy and a sense of home.
I'm not as familiar with the temporary home sites as I am more permanent housing solutions, and that's kind of what our focus has been. But there are pretty strict and clear guidelines as far as what the county is looking for in terms of temporary housing and how those get permitted. And each individual solution for temporary houses kind of also depends on where the manufacturer is and, you know, the specific solutions they're coming up with. But oftentimes the biggest challenge is how these things get connected to infrastructure and what the limitations are on water and wastewater, particularly here on Maui. That seems to be the biggest restriction on how these things come together.
I know that property cleanup in the places affected by the fire started earlier this year. Governor Josh Green told us last week that about 90% of displaced Maui residents were out of hotels and into different housing or more permanent housing or some sort of transitional housing. I can imagine right. That there are a number of people who are ready to take that next step towards replacing the home they lost. As someone with your experience as an architect who has experience with people building homes, do you have advice on where those folks can start that process?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the NHA website, helpingmaui.org, is a great place to start. It's a great resource to be connected with local architects and to get introduced to the process of rebuilding. And, you know, you can't underestimate the power of word of mouth. You know, if your family member or a neighbor is working with an architect that they're having success with, and I would definitely use the word of mouth recommendations to link up. And I know that all of us over here on Maui are all interconnected and trying to work together as best we can. And if we're not able to give somebody a specific solution, we try to refer people to, you know, somebody else that's got a good program going on as well. So, you know, the CNHA website is a great place to start, and word of mouth would be the next option.
Yeah, there's a lot of great information on the CNHA website. There's even a page specifically dedicated to the rebuilding process. I actually clicked on one of the links there. It's an informational workshop that kind of details or gives it more details, the steps that people can go through as they start the rebuilding process. How much did AIA contribute to that particular part of the website? What kind of insight do folks get from architects on the rebuild page of the website?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it was a very close relationship between CNHA and the AIA. The AIA Maui chapter has got a similar webpage that's giving people information on rebuilding and resources associated with the wildfires. And when CNHA reached out to the AIA, we were really instrumental in getting, you know, the call out to local architects to contribute, and contributed to the organization and kind of the formatting of how that website got laid out. So it was a really close relationship between the AIA and CNHA.
And I think you can tell in the information that they offer, there's some really good insight on what kind of help is available, whether it's free or reduced cost. I know that one of the ways that Hawaii Architects contributed to this rebuilding process is making several architectural plans for homes available for folks for free or at reduced prices. And these plans, I've looked through them. There's several on there. These plans are for home structures starting at 500 square feet all the way up to 3,700 square feet. Can you talk about some of those plans, the ones that maybe you might be familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, the needs in Lahaina are so varied, right? I mean, just lot size alone, there's parcels in Wahikuli that are above 10,000 square feet, and then you've got other parcels in parts of Lahaina Luna that are on the smaller side. So the need for all these different sizes are really important. And not only for main dwellings, but the people are always asking about accessory dwelling units as well. So the smaller units or the smaller houses that we've got on that website, you know, can be used for both main dwellings and could be used to construct accessory dwelling units. But in general, we're encouraging everybody to think about accessory dwelling units just from a housing shortage standpoint, as much as we can get out there for people, the better.
What I saw was a bunch of different sizes of homes, you know, whether someone's able to build, you know, a large home on there that may accommodate a lot of family or some smaller homes that may be able to suit their needs that way as well. There are some questions that I had about the permitting process. I know that, you know, permitting for new buildings, there tends to be a logjam in all of our counties here in our state. Do you know if there's a fast track or if there's a way for the homes that are built using these plans on this website, if those homes get fast tracked through the permitting process?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. So the answer to the fast track permitting is Maui County has hired an outside, a third party consulting firm to process building permits in the affected areas of Lahaina. And the process is much faster. The turnaround times for reviews are, you know, a matter of weeks as opposed to a matter of months, which is just amazing given, you know, the long timeline that we've grown accustomed to here. And in addition to that process, the plans that are on the website, some people have got pre-approval on those, which can even further speed up that process. And as for the plans that we've got on there, we're working towards getting pre-approval on those as well. And that pre-approval process with Maui County only gets you through a couple of the agencies, and you still need planning department approval and water approval and a few of the agencies to sign off. But getting a pre-registered or pre-approved plan with the County of Maui is a really good way to speed everything up.
One thing I thought was really cool, looks like the plans called for a lot of fire-resistant materials in the plans. And I know, you know, nothing can ever be fireproof when it comes to these kinds of situations, but having more fire resilient or fire resistant materials in the homes, I can only imagine that that helps protect against future disasters like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody's got so much more awareness now after the fire, of course, and are receptive to those kinds of design decisions and design suggestions. And it by far is one of the biggest questions that people have when they come to talk to us is, how are we addressing, you know, these types of things, and how are we going to make our home as safe as we possibly can moving forward?
Those were all the questions that I had, Jeremy. Is there anything that you think you want to share or think is important for our listeners to know about this process and, you know, just putting themselves in a position to be able to rebuild, you know, as quickly as reasonably possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just reiterate that between the AIA and CNHA, there's a lot of resources out there. Everybody's doing everything that they can possibly do to help reduce cost and give good information. So I would encourage everybody to reach out to those resources and get the process started. I mean, I know how daunting it can be to start that process, and both the AIA and CNHA are really dedicated to helping that process go a little bit smoother and a little bit easier for folks.
Jeremy, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate being able to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you, Russell. Take care.
That was architect Jeremy Stoddard talking with HVR's Russell Subiono. We will have a link to those architectural plans that they talked about on the conversation page of our website later today. And Maui County's final wildfire recovery plan meeting will be held this Saturday at the Lahaina Luna High School cafeteria at 3 p.m.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
It's almost high season for albacore tuna fishermen along the Pacific coast. Well, it would be, but for climate change.
For the first time ever in 44 years, I'm contemplating not even untying my boat.
I'm Kai Rizdal, warmer planet, warmer oceans. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
And now it's time for the Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we told you about a suspension bridge across the Hanamaʻulu Stream commissioned by the County of Kauai in the 1940s. Prior to its construction, community members used a footbridge to cross the stream daily for work, school, shopping, church, and play. But it would periodically get washed away in annual floods. And in the past, at least two attempts were made to shore it up with cement footings, but it wasn't enough. So in 1948, a 125-foot-long suspension bridge was constructed to connect plantation families of the upper and lower Kapaya Valley. Some say the Kapaya Swinging Bridge, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz, was also a bridge between the cultures of immigrant workers during the plantation days. It was rebuilt in 2018, and today a sign for the new structure reads, "Its existence allowed people of diverse backgrounds to interact with each other, resulting in tolerance, understanding, acceptance, and respect for all people." Thanks to Kim Perry for today's quiz. We had no winners, though. If you have an idea for a quiz, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hano, hano.
Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow on The Long View, we talk about the economy, consumer pessimism or optimism. Share your comments or questions about what you heard on our show by calling our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.